Good afternoon, welcome to the RSA. I'm Mary Ryan, I'm the Joint Head of the Public Events Programme here, and I want to welcome you all to our regular RSA Thursday lunchtime slot. It's my great pleasure to hand over swiftly to our chair for today's discussion, Mark Lynas. As many of you will know, Mark has worked for over a decade as a climate change specialist. He's the author of three award-winning books on the subject, High Tide, News from a Warming World, Carbon Calculator, and 6 Degrees, Our Future on a Hotter Planet. He's one of our most influential writers and broadcasters on environmental concerns, and he writes and reviews widely, as I'm sure you'll all know. So we couldn't have a better guide for today's discussion, and I'm going to hand over straight to Mark.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, I've just come from a conference at Oxford University called 4 Degrees, and it's been, I don't know if you saw any of the headlines in the press on Monday and Tuesday about this, but basically this was a collection of the latest scientific data being presented by scientists from the Hadley Centre and from elsewhere around the world. And it's really interesting that I asked the whole gathering to do a poll, if you like, put the hands up. And I said to them, what do you think is most realistic now? Is 4 degrees alarmist? No one put their hand up. I said, is 4 degrees realistic? It was unanimous. So it really goes to show that climate scientists now are almost giving up on restraining global warming to a level which would be less than dangerous. And I think if you look at some of the impact studies that were presented about what 4 degrees of warming would mean, it's very little short of catastrophic.
Yes.
Now, of course, we've got the Copenhagen conference upcoming in December, which essentially has the task of saving Kyoto from the sort of moribund state that it's been in for the last few years. And if there's anybody who can tell us how this can happen and why Kyoto should be saved, it's our guest who I'm delighted to introduce to you today, Graciela Chytilnicki, who actually was probably responsible for writing most of the rules which we all see in operation today in terms of how the world is beginning to restrain and beginning to regulate carbon emissions, particularly the operation of the carbon market. So Graciela actually put the carbon market bits into the Kyoto Protocol, which brought in the US, this was back in 1997, and the EU and the developing countries, set up the CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism, and enabled the whole process to take off, albeit slowly. So we're going to hear from Graciela in a minute about what the future may hold on that. But I want to give a bit more biographical details, and I'm going to have to read them off because you've done so much that it's difficult for me to retain in my small mind. Now, you're one of, as I said, about one of the leading authors, not just in the Kyoto Protocol, but also on conserving biodiversity and ecosystem services, and particularly to improve the lot of the poor. Graciela was the author of the now widely used concept of basic needs in economic development, which created this, the whole sustainable development framework, which was then taken up by the Brundtland Commission, if any of you are old enough like me to remember when that came out. And she designed financial instruments called catastrophe bundles and is the author of 13 books and 200 scientific articles. This is extraordinary, and is still so young. So it just goes to show what you can do if you put your mind to it. Graciela, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I'm very pleased to have Mark with us. And to be able to talk with you, this is my first lecture on the topic in the UK this time around since the book just appeared. And of course, there is much more up-to-date information in the UK about the issue of climate change, global warming, than it is in the United States. So it's a particularly good opportunity, and I thank you to the organizers and to Mark for being here. I'm very interested in the part in which we exchange ideas, so I'm going to go as quickly as I can. First, I will start from a number of photographs. I'm not going to say very much. And I want to give you these photographs because this is not an economic issue or a scientific issue or a cultural issue. This is a real issue. And it's an issue that is emotionally felt and has to be understood for what it is. So I want to just present to you the photographs so that we get into the mood without saying very much, if you allow me. And the photographs are very beautiful anyway. So this is about the melting glaciers and ice sheets in Antarctica, where I was recently. I was born in Argentina, and Argentina, Ushuaia, is the closest place to the Antarctica in the planet. Now, as you probably know, the towns in Alaska are all sinking. under the warming seas. These are pictures about some of the glaciers that are, and the sheets, the ice sheets that are melting, like in Greenland, also in the southern pole. These are some of the pictures of the melting glaciers you can see there in Patagonia. These are some of the global warming signals because of the shifting of the vector illnesses with the temperature. This is a familiar picture which is in the front of my book, actually. This is perhaps less known, that 25% of the landmass in China is desertified. You probably know about the longest drought in history, in the oldest continent, Australia. This is an example of what's happening, changing the landscape. In the United States, the mighty Colorado doesn't make it to the sea anymore. It is perhaps not well known that the entire California ecosystem depends on the water from this river. This is Las Vegas eating up the water from this lake. These are droughts and fires. And these are some of our cousins that are either in danger or disappearing in what is the sixth largest episode of extinction in the planet. That's where we are now. Comparable only with an episode 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs disappeared, with a rate of extinction that the United Nations showed is 1,000 times higher than fossil records. 50% of the corals in the Caribbean are disappearing because they are basic and the more acidic water, the acid being produced by the capture of CO2, it's just killing them. And here is a question for you. Is this the point of no return? The author of 4 degrees can tell you about that. 5 degrees is considered catastrophic. 4 degrees is close to that. I was a lead author of the IPCC, which is the institution that got the Nobel Prize in 2007, Nobel Peace Prize for the work in this area of global warming. And I can assure you, we looked at the issue of 5 degrees very seriously, and 4 is right there. And furthermore, we now have geopolitics at stake, because the US and China are engaged in an emissions war, very reminiscent of what we observed last century with the Cold War between Russia and the United States. A new Cold War, perhaps, all about warming. Let me tell you quickly what we're going to see. So first, the world today, and then the world of the future. The Copenhagen starts from there. Then the China-US, what I describe as a new Cold War on emissions, how to overcome the impasse, and that's what the article in Time magazine that just appeared is about, and I believe we have made this available. It's here, yeah. In the recent issue on, it's called Environmental Heroes or something like that, in Time magazine. I have a copy. I want to talk about negative carbon. Mark was asking me about it. It's very important. Not how to overcome the impasse that has a financial forward market solution, but how to really get at the issue, focusing on what matters, which is the future developments in Africa, Latin America, particularly the small island states, that they are the ones that have more at risk, most vulnerable. And to link the issue of global warming with a real increase in energy needs all over the world, which is all disconnected with the next generation Kyoto. That's what we're doing at the end of the year in Copenhagen. So the Kyoto Protocol is the first and only global agreement we have on emissions, and it was signed in 1997. It became international law quite implausibly in 2005. This has been like Rocky II. Seriously. I mean, everybody thought it was dead because the United States opposed it. And it has been, you know, a real roller coaster of up and down, hope and despair. But in 2005, it became international law. And quite implausibly, the wealthy nations, who are the responsible for 60% of all emissions, agreed to limit their emissions. Not enough, as Mark will tell you. It's only 5% reduction by 2012, but it's the principle and the beginning of a process. In introducing the carbon market, which I militated for and actually wrote in Kyoto, I helped create the first global environmental market, a market that exists for 15 years in the United States, not global, on SO2, sulfur dioxide, but a different type of market because it treats the developing nations differently, as it should, because it's about a global public good. Trading now over $60 billion in 2008, with $23 billion being transferred from the rich to the poor nations to develop clean industrialization or clean projects. Doesn't go through governments. No corruption, no nothing. It's just directly private. And the price in this carbon market is what we economists call the carbon price signal. It's a major economic incentive that penalizes those who emit, and you know about that. But what you may not focus on is that it rewards those who decrease emissions. And actually, in the book, Saving Kyoto, we make this simple point. With the carbon market in place, you can resolve the entire global warming problem at no cost to the global economy. It's really a redistribution, but not a net cost. And by that redistribution, I mean those of us who over-emit have to pay, and we compensate those of us who under-emit. I don't think anybody here is in the second, those of us, including myself. We are all into the part that has to pay. But for the global economy as a whole, with the carbon market in place and the right targets, this redistribution costs net zero in terms of finding the solution to global warming. All we have to do is set the levels at the level that is needed. More on that soon. However, the Kyoto Protocol is not perfect, as you might have noticed. First of all, there is no limits on the developing nations' emissions, which are 40% of the total emissions, with China 18%. China and the U.S. are the largest emitters. Not surprising, but true, because emissions are all about industrialization. Now, you may say, well, so what? They're only 40%, and you're right. But we can, here in the OECD nations, stop emitting tomorrow morning, go to zero, for which all of us will have to hold our breath. Why? Because when you breathe, you emit CO2. So it's not likely to happen. But even if it did happen, it wouldn't matter, because the developing nations, in 20 years' time, can be the largest emitters in the world, and therefore the problem is still with us. The Clean Development Mechanism, as you probably know, gives major financial incentives for the nations that don't participate in the carbon market because they don't have emissions. And the way it works is that if you have a project that can be certified on the soil of a developing nation to reduce emissions, the investors from the industrial nations will get credits that they can then take and transform into money in the carbon market at the rate of $25, $30 a ton saved. This means big incentives to invest productively and in clean technologies in developing nations. So much so that $23 billion have gone so far, implying a 20% reduction in the European Union emissions. We can talk more about that because there is all sorts of issues around it. But China was 60%, and some say more recently 80% of all of this. The reason is simple. The CDM rewards emissions reductions. So those who have more to emit, like China, are the ones that got most of the money and most of the projects. And the nations in Africa who emit only 3% of the global emissions, or Latin America, a similar amount, basically got nothing. Perverse. But it can be fixed, and it should be fixed. We're going to talk about that soon. There is also the fact that the carbon market is supposed to become the largest commodity market in the world. I just come from a meeting on the World Economic Forum on global economic risks. I can assure you, the global environmental risks and the commodity market, like the carbon market, are not in the radar scheme. They just don't even know this problem exists. It's very interesting, but it's true. Yet, the Kyoto Protocol with this carbon market became a solution which is a market solution, therefore liked by the United States, and I sold to them very hard. But it's also a solution with equity, because it treats preferentially the developing nations. Therefore, both the North and the South saw different things, the opposite things. The North saw the efficiency, the South saw the equity, they signed on, we got, at the 11th and a half hour, we got a Kyoto Protocol because of that. I call that solution the two sides of the coin. The same coin just has to look different to the two sides, and then you have an agreement, because the positions of the two sides are so divergent. But Kyoto is only a first step. First of all, like Cinderella, it disappears, becomes a pumpkin at the touch of 12. 2012, poof, gone. But, you know, that's by design, as in the case of Cinderella. It was programmed to be that way. I love to talk about that, and there is no time. But this is all about whoever is a political science or is interested here. It's about bureaucracies trying to self-reproduce themselves into infinity. Well, the Kyoto Protocol killed itself. It says we end up at 2012. This is experimental. Needs to be renegotiated. That's the purpose of Copenhagen, 2009. And in Bali, 2007, President Bush, not one of my favorite presidents, but still, he said, our nation is addicted to oil. Good thinking. And then he said, we're going to participate in the Kyoto Protocol process in 2009 in Copenhagen. So you owe it to Bush. It's quite unbelievable, but that's true. So far, the U.S. does not participate. Wait a second. The U.S. did sign in 1997. And by its own signature, when ratified by 55% of the emitting nations, the U.S. is bound by the Kyoto Protocol as international law. Yet, it doesn't participate. Therefore, through that indirectly or directly, Kyoto Protocol lacks control on 26% of the global emissions that come from the United States. Our nation emits 26% and uses almost 30% of the oil produced in the entire world, even though we have a little bit less than 5% of the world population. Lacking limits on developing nations' emissions hinders U.S. participation. It is the rallying cry of conservatives in the U.S. Senate. And we now have the U.S.-China impasse, what could develop into a new Cold War. Yet, there has been progress in the U.S. The economic incentives of Kyoto are enormous. And that was a sneaky way to try to get people, as I said, the profits from the carbon market, not just the cost. They are both. They are equal. President Obama wishes to participate for good reasons, good intentions. California and other states and hundreds of cities and towns want to participate. And the Supreme Court ruled that the federal government can do it. Global business and even the famous Goldman Sachs, or infamous Goldman Sachs, has some of the most important practices in these carbon credits. And for an unlikely, and this is the Rocky II aspect, in May of this year, U.S. Congress passed the energy bill calling for emissions limits, I should say, the House of Representatives, passed for a law requiring emission limits and cap and trade in the United States. Totally unlikely, but it was the most ferocious enemy of Kyoto, turned around. But it still has not been ratified in the Senate. What about the road ahead? Emission limits for developing nations? No, because there is an Article 4 signed in 1992 by all nations, including the United States, the developing nations will not be required to limit emissions unless they are compensated. And now stop me if I become too technical about it, because to me these details, which are technical, are the core of the issue. Just stop me so I stop sounding like the Encyclopedia Britannica and I communicate with you. But this is an important issue. That's called Article 4. And what about U.S. participation? Between the two of them is, watch, 66% of the global emissions. Okay, the two are linked. Worse than that, what we're doing now is nothing compared to where we're going now, because most of the world energy comes from fossils. And in the rest of the century, we're going to increase energy use, according to the International Energy Agency, and generally believe 5 to 10 times what we're doing now. So if this is what we're doing now, and this may lead to 4, God forbid, 6 degrees, then at the end of the century, we are like this. So the problem right now is nothing compared to what's coming. The long-run solution is renewables. Everybody and their uncle knows that. Only renewable energy will do. And it will help also the oil-addicted nations, according to President Bush, like the United States. And we're talking about wind, biofuel, nuclear, geothermal, hydroelectric. But they are all in limited supply. They cannot replace, because of their limitations in supply, the scope of fossil fuels. Only solar energy can do it. I am in favor of concentrated solar power that produces heat. Don't let me get technical about it, although the technical details are very important. Just to point out, with known technology, what we know today, with less than 1% of the energy that we receive from the sun, we can provide 10 times more fossil fuel, more energy than the fossil fuels do. Furthermore, solar energy is more democratically distributed than fossil fuels. And remember, 89% of all the global energy today is between 87 and 89. Again, don't let me get technical. Is fossil, gas, oil, and coal. Only 10%, this is important to know, is nuclear, geothermal, and hydroelectric. Hydroelectric, we almost exhausted it. Not quite. It's at the limit. By the way, nuclear, don't worry about nuclear. And what I mean about that is there isn't enough nuclear fuel. So no matter what, we cannot not even get close to replacing fossil fuels with nuclear energy. We should worry for other reasons. You know, it has security reasons, big time, long-term effects, but it's not an alternative. And people just don't think about that. And as I said, photovoltaic and solar thermal, less than 1% of solar power is enough for what we want. But the short run, solar is not it. There is no time to transform the entire fossil infrastructure. It costs $46 trillion to do so. Wait a second. I'm not against solar energy. In fact, that's my preferred solution, although we need everything, all the span. Solar is it. But you can't do it in the short run. No way. As I say, in the United States, where about 26% of the population talks Spanish, like I do, no way, Jose. Now, negative carbon is it. Mark is going to ask all about this. It's about reducing carbon in the atmosphere now. Now you will say, yeah, we've been talking about it. No, I haven't. I talked so far, and Kyoto talks about reducing emissions. Now I'm talking about the more radical solution. Why? Because we've been procrastinating for years. And we now need a more radical solution in the short run. Negative carbon means sucking carbon from the atmosphere. Let's say, just to explain the difference, if you stabilize emissions totally and you say, wow, we did it. No, you didn't. Because once emitted, carbon dioxide stays uniformly and stably in the entire atmosphere. And what this means is that if you stabilize emissions, you stabilize the global warming process and you go steadily to what may be called, but I won't use the word, hell. I mean, in terms of heat, you understand? So, CCS, what CCS? Oh, it says CSS. It meant to say CCS. Carbon capture and storage is a procedure used by the oil industry for 16 years, including in North Sea oil, mostly Norway and North Africa, etc. And this is used to extract carbon from the flue, inject it in cavities where the oil comes from, by which you increase petroleum output by 30%, sometimes 40%. So, for example, Occidental Petroleum in Texas, all of its petroleum is produced from CCS. I'm not going to get technical. I'm going to stay away from that. Right. Air capture. What is air capture? Well, it's a technique of which there are three different manifestations, and I'm involved in the third, of which you put a piece of equipment out there, and it goes chuku chuku chuku, and it takes carbon from air. And you say, wow, that's weird, right? Well, it's weird, but the Royal Academy, and I suppose we're sitting here, has a report that just came out saying that it is totally, it's not weird, it's real. And it talks about geoengineering. I can send it to you if you want. But it doesn't suffice. Because if we cannot use it in the existing plants. If we use it in the new plants, and we're building two plants a week in the world, if you use it in new plants, we continue and stabilize emissions. And as I said, if we stabilize emissions, Mark will tell you, don't believe me, where we're going in terms of the degrees. By steadily producing 30 gigaton of carbon, and no more, so we stabilize, continuously every year, he will let you know. That's 4 degrees. That's 5 degrees, okay? So my ideal solution is to combine air capture with solar thermal electricity so that, watch this, you can produce more power and reduce carbon from the atmosphere. The long and the short run are different. You have different risk management results. Different policies, long-run strategies do not work for the short run because we need to adopt renewables, no time for that. Yet, when you adopt a short-term strategy, you need to do one that accelerates the renewable energy use. And the CCS won't do that. It stabilizes us. It locks us into the fossil fuel paradigm. This is a CCS that we use today. If we do that, we defeat the long-run goals. Then, you know, might as well stop talking. So to move forward in Copenhagen, we have to overcome the China-US impasse. The interests of industrial and developing nations are so opposed that once again we need a two-sided coin. We need economic incentives for the short and the long run. We need to bring aboard US and the G77 nations, and we need to assist the real victims, which are the small island nations. They are the first ones that will suffer, hundreds of millions of people at stake. Here are the principles. We need a way forward that involves overcoming the North-South divide, also known as the China-US war, clean technology transfer, future emissions reductions by developing nations, China, India, and the Article 4 that I talked about before, and use the CDM as a foundation for a major shift in energy use, negative carbon. Here are the two solutions. The first one appears in the article in Time magazine that I was told would be available to you. It's here. And therefore, I'm not going to tell you a lot about it because the editor of Time magazine, Simon Robinson, did a fantastic job. So my article is actually very readable. No, it is. I mean, he deserves the credit. But it's really a paradigm shift. Based on existing law, I found a financial solution based on the sovereign bilateral options, based on the carbon market that can overcome the China-US impasse. And in 2009, a Chinese official at a meeting with 100 other nations at the United Nations in April agreed with this proposal. As far as I know, my proposal is the only proposal that Chinese agreed to officially and available through the UN UNCTAD website on record. This is a market solution with equity. But the second thing is, wait a second, we can agree we can get a resolution, we can get everybody, China and the U.S. into the picture, but we still have the global warming problem. How are we going to do that? Africa, Latin America, and the small islands can turn carbon negative. Africa right now doesn't get any CDM because it only emits 3% of the emissions. We need Africa to be able to suck 20% of the emissions as opposed to the 3% it emits. Then it can attract real funds and change. Otherwise, it can't. This can be done. Cost? It can be done by developing power plants that suck carbon from air. The more energy they produce, the more carbon they reduce. Unbelievable? True. Read the Royal Academy report. Cost, $200 billion per year, is just right for a global stimulus. And, interestingly enough, we don't need any good donor nations. By the way, I don't believe in the existence of good donor nations. But this system works. Kyoto works. The Kyoto Protocol and CDM can fund this. Over 15 years, we can actually deal with the 30 gigatons that we are emitting, leading to economic growth and carbon reduction. I was going to tell you more about air capture, but let me just give you this slide and stop here. Air capture today, not yesterday and not before, because there are three generations, is negative carbon. It makes a power plant a sink, and watch, it makes a solar power plant, like a concentrated solar power, a larger and better sink. So it's a transition technology. It goes in favor of renewables. Results can resolve global warming and produce power plants that suck carbon from air. The more power they produce, the more carbon they reduce, helping the developing nations like Africa and Latin America obtain resources from the Kyoto Protocol, and generally speaking, resolving the North-South issue as well as the global warming problem going forward. Why don't I just stop here? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I knew you'd be enthusiastic.
Well, I think that was fantastic, but in danger of being a little optimistic. And I don't like optimism when we're talking about climate change.
You want me to answer
that?
Yeah.
Well, okay. If I was to draw a graph of emissions, and I was looking at the global emissions data the other day because that's the kind of guy I am, it goes up like that, sort of, and you get to this point, it goes, shoots up. And that point was 1997, and that was when the Kyoto Protocol was signed.
Yes.
So, obviously, correlation does not imply causation, so I'm not suggesting that Kyoto Protocol made emissions shoot up, but it does suggest that it didn't work.
Yeah, Mark is right. That's what I was trying to say. I was trying to say we've been procrastinating. The solutions that Kyoto envisioned in 1997, which are to reduce emissions, are great, but they are not any longer available because we increased emissions after Kyoto. We did not fulfill the Kyoto agreement. Not only we didn't fulfill, the Kyoto Agreement is totally incapacitated because 66% of the emissions are outside it. Anyway, it's just a step. Am I optimistic? Okay, let me tell you what I am. In the very long run, or in the medium long run, yes, I'm optimistic. Not only am I optimistic, I'm very optimistic. I do believe that with the improved carbon market, with this air capture and negative carbon technologies, of which there are a few, we can resolve the problem and we can actually transfer productive technologies and resources to the developing nations in Africa and Latin America. We can do it. I'm very optimistic in that sense. About the short run, I'm very pessimistic. And the reason is that the problem that we have is not lack of technology. It's not lack of innovation. The problem we have is the inability of humans to come to grips with reality, something in which I'm quoting other authors, and number two, to create institutions that we need to get there. That's why I dedicated myself almost single-handedly to the creation of the Kyoto Protocol, and I was there at 11 and a half hour, and that's what the carbon market did, and that's why I'm here today, talking, instead of doing my fancy writing, you know, whatever it is that I write. It's extremely important, and we are constrained in a capsule. We have a reality that is limited, and we are very unable to create now the global institutions that we need to get out of here. So, is it possible? Hell yes. Is it going to happen?
No.
I don't know.
Well, not right.
I think it's going to happen, but it's...
Yeah, but you mentioned about short-term...
Touch and go. Touch
short-term
and go.
Pessimism. I mean, we've got... obviously, there's a big campaign about what we all do for the Copenhagen conference, whether we all march on the streets, whether we burn the place down. I don't know what. I mean, what do you think the best ask is? What should we be demanding all these negotiators to come out with at Copenhagen?
Okay, there are two things.
Don't walk out.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, I wasn't meaning to walk out. Okay, first of all, get the China-US red herring out of the picture so we can do the real thing. It is like a proxy war because there is a geopolitical situation of competition. And now they're using the emissions as a way to create another form of Cold War. We got to defuse that. That's why I proposed this. And so far I spoke with Carol Browner, who is the Obama's advisor. I spoke with people in the United States. More importantly, I spoke with the Chinese officials. I spoke with the Indian officials. Everybody agrees that this is a perfectly reasonable solution. And what it will do, the solution that I mentioned, I can explain more if you have questions, and it's written in that report by Time Magazine this week, is diffuse. Get that red herring out of the picture, the geopolitical nonsense competition between the superpowers. But the reality of it is we have to resolve what got us here in the first point. What got us here in the first point, and is not going away, even if we resolve the global warming problem, is the overuse of the world resources. Simple. And this is a north-south issue, because the resources come from the developing nations. It's like market colonialism. I have written so much, I'm not going to go into detail. So we have to overcome the north-south divide, so that Latin American and Africans don't keep on having this incentive to dump more and more of their precious resources that we overconsume here to the detriment of the entire global system. But I'm not going to go into that, but if we don't solve the problem of the global divide, we will continue having this overuse of natural resources in the global economy. And the overuse of global resources is pretty serious with global warming, but in my opinion, it's even more serious for global biodiversity. And if you don't believe me, go find out what's happening with water now. Water is a more scarce resource than petroleum. And the scarcity of water is more severe than the emissions, even in the medium run. Water.
No, I think you're right about that, and biodiversity as well. In fact, there's a paper published in Nature last week about the planetary boundaries concept that a lot of scientists are working on, what the ecological limits are, not just in climate, but in water, in biodiversity, in nitrogen cycle, all of this stuff. So do go and look at that. It's not behind a password, unusually, for what's on Nature. Now, how many of you have burning questions here?
Musuk Kwanga, I'm the Director for Press at the Institute for Philanthropy. We advise wealthy donors on giving. We're recently releasing a report called Funding Strategically in the Area of Climate Change. It's coming out in a few weeks. My question actually is that, do you feel the price of carbon is actually far, far too low to affect market behaviour? Because I look at that, and that price doesn't seem to me to reflect or even affect consumer behaviour at a corporate level or an individual level. So how much higher do you think the price of carbon should be if it is indeed underpriced?
It's really a good question for you as an economist, isn't it?
Yeah, but I have to tell you this. Oscar Wilde, you must know who he is, once said, an economist is somebody who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. And I have to say this is a very accurate statement. There are two fundamentals in the carbon market price. Everything else doesn't really matter, it's oscillations. One, the technology to transform goods into emissions, or rather, you know, how much does it cost to restrain emissions? The other one, the level that we set, that's the IPCC and the United Nations, for total global emissions. This is it. You have those two, you set the price. Up to now, we couldn't really set the limit because 66% of the market was out, the developing nations and the United States. But I think what's going to drive the price is the technological ability, how much does it cost in terms of goods and services to reduce carbon from the atmosphere. That's the cost of capturing 1 ton of carbon from the atmosphere, let's say through air capture or other methodologies. Answer, somewhere between $25 and $50. And the market is about $25. Wait. The air capture of other colleagues of mine, like Klaus Lagner, is at $100 a ton. So therefore, it is somewhere between $25 and $100. Currently, it's closer to $100 to really make a difference. But there is so much leakage because 66% of the market is missing.
Just do the air capture thing quickly. How does it work? I know it's patent pending, so it's a complete secret.
No, it's not totally, because some of the patents are already valid.
But I mean, you've got the power station, you've got some waste heat, and you're then...
Yeah, here's the story. It's really fascinating. When you have a power plant, like a fossil fuel, or preferably a CSP, concentrated solar power, my preferred type of solar plant, then you get excess heat that is unnecessary because it cannot be transformed into electricity. Here's the thing. I'm talking about heat of 100 centigrades. You know, the heat that you need to boil a cup of tea, right? That heat cannot be used to move a turbine and produce electricity. It's too low. So it's rejected by the plant. So when you finish using the high heat, and the heat has now decreased to the level where it cannot be used for electricity anymore, it's called process heat.
And that's what you see going up the cooling towers, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
At that time, we come in and we have a special process to use 100 degrees centigrade. Instead of boiling a cup of tea, you capture carbon from the atmosphere. Once you capture it, you still have to transform it into something solid that stays where it is. 16 years have shown that it can be captured in geological cavities, and it stays. Believe me, MIT has a lot of records that it is effective and it stays. My preferred solution, transform it into ethanol through algae. Now, I'm not inventing this. Ethanol, to use in the transportation sector, which is 15% of the global emissions. Or there is now a process, a firm called Calera, that actually puts it into cement. Why? Because carbon dioxide in nature, through the use of shells, which is calcium carbonate, gets combined and becomes cement. So you can actually capture the carbon into cement. And nature is doing this today.
Thank you. I'm Priscilla Augustson. I'm a professor at London University. Thank you very much for coming to speak to us. I am a little confused, though, because I believe you said 4 degrees would be we could still sort as 5. But I understand from Mark Lynas' book, 6 degrees, that really 2 and 3 degrees are unbelievably catastrophic, and 4 is sort of unimaginably beyond survival. Could we establish between you two? I know it sounds as if it's conjuring figures out of the air, but surely we have to have some kind of agreed basis of danger.
Well, first of all, I think it's fair to tell this public that when you increase 1 degree, it may look very small, but that's an average. Typically in the poles, it goes up 3 times as much. It could be 3 times as much. So if you increase 2 or 3 degrees, you are talking close to 10 degrees in the pole, in the north and the south pole. Now, why am I talking about the poles? Because the poles harbor a lot of ice mass. And if you increase that 10 degrees, well, forget about the poles, the ice mass, and then you can have a rise in the sea level of a meter or a meter and a half. I mean, this is serious. Now, how it is almost impossible, in my view, to go below 2 to 3 degrees increase, given the inertia of the system right now. We are lucky that we have him as a specialist. He can tell you more about that. But I agree with you, 4 degrees is close to catastrophic. 5 degrees will be 15 degrees in the poles. So what are we talking about? I tell you what we're talking about. We're talking about New York City under the water, hundreds of millions of people. You know, there is 50 million people this year that are climate change refugees. In the year 2012, that's going to go up by 200 million people. Anyway, I think that question requires an answer for him.
Yeah, but I'm not here to do the talking, really. Very quickly, I think 2 degrees has been identified as the sort of safe level. I wouldn't say it's safe because it means losing the world's coral reef. It means losing most mountain glaciers, and it means a major transformation of biomes and disruption of ecosystems and a fairly significant mass extinction. But that's the best we can achieve given the way that emissions are going at the moment. We have to get emissions going down again, so past the peak, within about 5 to 10 years from now to have any realistic chance of staying below 2 degrees. Above that, then you have the danger of carbon cycle feedback. So carbon coming out of the soils, out of the Amazon rainforest, perhaps if that collapses, out of the Siberian permafrost, which then keeps us going on up the scale through the century. So that's why that's sort of been defined as a sort of arbitrary safe level. I don't think anyone's saying that 4 degrees is safe in any way, shape, or form. That would be, it's unimaginable. You have to go back 30 million years to find a planet that was 4 degrees warmer than now, and there was hardly any ice on it at all. So
that's why we spoke about negative carbon, and He kept saying, talk about air capture. Again, and maybe I went too fast over that, because we live with this, so we think of it as natural. Negative carbon means we don't limit emissions, because that's not good enough anymore. He will tell you, I can tell you, I have written, I can send you articles if you send me your email about that. We need to go carbon negative. We need to not just stabilize emissions. We need to start pulling out physically. We have to get close up and personal with those molecules of carbon, and we have to pull them down from the atmosphere. It is too late otherwise.
My name is Herbert Marsh-Williams. I'm an RSA fellow. You mentioned the Cold War, the US-China Cold War. Maybe you should, to some degree, include India in that as well. I was in India last week, and it's very interesting to see the different perspective that the Indian government, for example, has on climate change negotiations. When they came back from the G20, the G20 meeting in Pittsburgh, they were actually very pleased at not having to come to any sort of concrete agreement about climate change mitigation, preferring to actually wait until Copenhagen because they were worried their interests would actually be damaged. Now, my question or issue is this. If you look at the States, if you look at the average member of Congress or the average U.S. citizen, they don't travel outside of the U.S. very much. Most Americans actually don't even have passports. It's probably the same in China, probably the same in India. So is there a cultural thing that's going on here as well, whereby, in fact, people do not understand each other's perspectives? The Americans don't understand the perspective of the Chinese. The Chinese perhaps don't understand the perspective of the Americans, and the Indians included. That actually makes the negotiations much harder. We're not talking about global warming in a sense, because it's not a shared perspective of a global problem. It's actually a regional perspective, and that is actually one of the barriers or the difficulties that are created.
Right. So sort of cultural barriers between different countries.
Kirby is absolutely right. We share one atmosphere, and carbon dioxide is different from all other gases I know, like sulfur dioxide, in that it distributes uniformly over the entire world. So if I go out of here and I measure outside here, in your backyard, I measure the CO2 composition, it's exactly the same of what I will be measuring right now in Beijing or in Madrid. So at the physical level, is totally shared, and is the global commons, big time. There is nothing more global than that. And we all emit carbon, so we all emit, and we all face the same concentration. That's about it. The cultural situation is totally different. For developing nations, the situation, remember the two-sided coin? For developing nations, this is, you know, we are just the victims here. We are 80% of the world economy, and historically and currently, we emit less than 40%. This is something that was caused by the industrialization, it was caused by the industrial nations, and they are the 20% of the world, and they are emitting 60% of the emissions. So unless they solve the problem, there is no solution. Let me be clear. Suppose everybody in the world was consuming fossil fuels and emitting the same thing as your average developing nation person in China or in India. Suppose that for a minute. Then you know what? We wouldn't have global warming. What this means is that for the developing nations, this is a problem that they didn't cause and they cannot resolve. So they are there saying, hey guys, we are sitting ducks. You caused it. We are suffering most of the consequences and we can't even fix it. Go fix it. That's why the Kyoto Protocol was so acceptable to the developing nations, because it put limits on the wealthy nations' emissions, which is really what is needed. However, the fact of the matter is that we are undergoing a cultural change. And guess where is India going to be in 20 years? Well, you know what? The future of the global atmosphere depends on India and depends on China, at least as much and perhaps more than the United States.
Hi, it's Michael Ridley. I work as a consultant at the Carbon Trust. Yeah, I had a question on developing countries because you've repeatedly talked about that. Actually, yeah, Mexico and South Korea are both quite interesting, and they've both talked about, although they're non-Annex 1 countries, they're prepared to take on targets at the Copenhagen discussions. Mexico has also proposed a green fund into which not just developed countries but developing countries would pay. And given what you're saying about the changing world, do you think that's a sort of an interesting development from Mexico and South Korea?
Well, not all developing countries are the same. China obviously has trillions of dollars of U.S. debt denominated in U.S. dollars that gives them certain perspective, shall we say, on the financial, the global financial system. Mexico is an OECD nation. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't.
Right. Which is not an... That's right. So they are OECD nations for a reason. They are in the border, right? But Mexico is very different from Bolivia. And Mexico is very different from the real victims in all this, who are the actors, and they are the small island nations. 43 of them. Hundreds of millions of people. I spoke with the president of the Maldives, President Nasheed, who, the Maldives is the nation that gave the famous speech, Death of a Nation. And he was the most powerful speaker last week in the Global Assembly of the United Nations, in the General Assembly. And they are trying to restrain themselves. But their entire nations are going to disappear. So they are the last ones. They have not, again, they are the sitting ducks. There is nothing they can do at
this. They've said they'll go carbon neutral in 10 years' time.
And they are. Yeah. They are, it's amazing. But here is the thing. With the negative carbon technology, I don't think I was able to explain this well. He understands because he breathes this stuff, okay? But you guys don't breathe this every day. So here's the story. The small island nations, there are 43 of them. Now, don't look down on 43. There is such a thing called global democracy at work. This means there are 194 nations in Copenhagen. 43 are small island nations. Now, you may say, yeah, but they're so small, let's worry about China. No, not so fast. In June 2009, 3 months away, the small island nations managed to put the issue of global warming as part of the of the Global Security Council of the United Nations. So it's become the similar or the same level of importance and priority as a war issue. It's now part of the Security Council. This was against the vote of the United States and Russia. That's what I mean by global democracy at work. The last will come first. By this I mean we are all aware that these are hundreds of millions of people that are going to suffer the consequences of global warming, and what they do and what they put on the table in Copenhagen in terms of proposals can succeed. With negative carbon, they can use the funds coming from the CDM of the Kyoto Protocol, and they can resolve 20 or 30% of the global emissions by building power plants that suck carbon from air, get the funding from that, and to take a giant step forward in extracting carbon from the atmosphere. They can do it. They know they can do it. With the proposals that I am making, that I am bringing with them to Copenhagen, this can be done. I don't know if I'm making the point clear. it's a very special moment. This is like a historical moment, really.
Right. And I think all the scientists at this conference in Oxford would agree that without air capture, certainly as a major part of the emissions curve in the second part of the century, we're not going to get anywhere. I mean, we've gone past that point of no return, really.
Yes, good afternoon. I wonder if you can help me on this. My name's Stephen Smythe. I'm involved in the recycling industry. We haven't touched upon population growth this afternoon. How do you think this will happen in the future with regard to carbon usage? Because we can solve these other problems without a growing population of the world.
Population is a red herring. The nations that emit most are the ones that have lowest population and lowest population growth. So I can show you the charts. Now, of course, this is not a linear issue in the sense that, in some sense, it's a population-driven problem, because the final solution will be to eradicate humans from the face of the earth. That's what I call the final solution. I'm being slightly facetious. And then we wouldn't have the problem anyway. And you know what? 99.9% of all the species that ever existed have gone extinct. So I don't know who we think we are, but let's hope that it doesn't happen to us. So it is not a problem, but it could be. Yet, the problem really is industrialization. And we all hope for the economic growth of the poor nations that desperately need something, because 50% of the population or more live with under $2 a day, and 1.3 billion people live with less than $1 per day, which is below the level of satisfaction of basic needs. So if they grow, that in itself could be a major source of emissions, because industrialization is the problem.
Yeah, hi, my name's Isabel Hilton. I run China Dialogue, which is a bilingual Chinese-English website on climate change and environmental issues. So to the earlier questioner, if you want to understand what Chinese think, you can find quite a lot of it there, because we publish Chinese writers. My question is that I wondered, the Annex 1, non-Annex 1 division, which strikes me as increasingly anomalous and made sense when it was thought up, but it's certainly not going to make sense going forward. But there doesn't seem to be any structural means of, as it were, removing this obstacle to future global deals. And I think that the developing non-Annex 1 countries recognize the anomaly and are trying to come up with ways of demonstrating that, yes, they do take their responsibility and so on, like the Indian commitment never to allow their emissions to rise above global average or so. But it's not built into the process. And I just wondered, for instance, we published an article by the Chinese economist Huang Gang advocating a graduation threshold based on the Human Development Index, where you would transfer from non-Annex 1 to Annex 1 and take on those responsibilities. I don't see anything in the current process that accommodates this fundamental problem, and I just wondered if you saw any prospect going forward of this changing and entering into a slightly more rational arrangement whereby Burundi was not in the same category as China.
Very good question. I'm restrained because of time and because I don't want to be too technical. But my proposal is really all based on Article 4 of the Convention. The issue is the following. We got to transform the paradigm, okay? It's not that you're wrong, you're absolutely right. But Article 4, if transformed the way I'm suggesting, allows for a continuation of the dual position of developing nations, which is what Article 4 allows. But it uses the real wording of Article 4. Don't forget I'm an expert, so here we go. Which is that it doesn't say developing nations won't have requirements to reduce emissions. It says you won't have requirements without compensation. So if you can develop the financial mechanisms, and that's what my financial mechanism does, you don't destroy Article 4. Now, Article 4 will not go away easily, and it shouldn't, because there are poor nations that are emitting nothing, and they cannot be treated, the nations in Africa, the nations in Latin America, they cannot be treated like the biggest emitters. Nor can you separate China. If you look at the GDP of China, there are 100 nations in the world above it. It's a poor nation, on average. So you cannot ask China to have a divide and conquer and separate from the developed G77. That's why my solution works. Having said that, I don't think there is any disagreement from any developing nation to have a graduating policy. So if we have a policy, it should be adapted to GDP levels or the human development level. When they reach that level, they reach that level of compromise. That is never going to be a problem. I can say more, but there is one thing I want to say. We have a unique opportunity. The carbon market, because of human greed, is spewing up dollars. Let's use those dollars to create power plants in the poorest nations that can suck up carbon. They will be favored by the OECD nations because it means more jobs, technology exports, which they want. So if we use the CDM mechanism that ties technology transfer with the transfer of funding to developing nations, we can do everything at once. By the way, between us, is the only mechanism that I know that can correct the large wealth imbalances in the global economy. So I think that's very important for the survival of humankind.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Now, you mentioned about how your Time magazine article was vastly improved by the editor. Well,
yes, it was.
This must also have been a very good editorial job, because it's eminently readable, and I know that because I devoured it on the train here. It merely remains for me to thank Professor Chichilnitsky for being such a passionate, engaging, and eloquent speaker, and thank you all for coming so much.